Blog Talk Radio.
I hate you both. I've hated you ever since I can remember. I hate you, and I wish you both had cancer.
Cancer?
Yes, in the head.
I'm as tired as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
You built a time machine out of a DeLorean?
People seem to like me because I am polite and I'm rarely late.
And now the host of the Stupid Cancer Show, Matthew Zachary.
Good evening, everybody. Monday, January 19th. And we are once again live on the Stupid Cancer Show, your friendly neighborhood weekly social webcast, finally giving voice to more than 1 million young adults affected by cancer. This radio broadcast is a program of the I'm Too Young for This Cancer Foundation. We are a national, survivor-led advocacy, research, and support foundation exclusively for survivors and their care providers under the age of 40. Got cancer under 40? Sucks. Hell, well, get busy living, because it's the Stupid Cancer Show, and I'm your host, Matthew Zachary. Welcome to tonight's broadcast, my friends. We are here to change the world one chemo infusion at a time and share all of the crapness that we know all too well. Now, call me a hippie, but do not call me a victim, because I don't believe that change is possible. You never disrupt and challenge the status quo. I am still here. You are still here. This is why we fight. Forget the cure, folks. That's right, you heard it here first. Forget the cure. Survivorship is all that matters. Tonight, cancer prevention and alternative medicine, environmental ecology. Very, very interesting topics. I'll be speaking with Ann Fonfa, breast cancer survivor and advocate from the Annie Appleseed Project, and Dr. Deborah Davis, the director of the Center for Environmental Oncology at the University of Pittsburgh Cancer Institute, and the author of one of my favorite books, The Secret History of the War on Cancer. We'll be discussing how cell phones might be the new cigarettes. So hello, my friends, and welcome to yet another fun-filled and exciting romp through the hay on tonight's Stupid Cancer Show, and a Stupid Cancer welcome to all of our first-time listeners here on the Blog Talk Radio Network, our new home on the Internet. And on last week's show, we did cervical cancer and spoke with Jen Pates, Michelle Whitlock, and Robin Pates from Tamika and Friends. We're wrapping up January, which is Cervical Cancer Awareness Month, which is pretty cool. Now, I had the pleasure of leaving the frigid temperatures in the New York City metro area this past weekend to head off to Orlando in Florida. I was asked by the Leukemia Lymphoma Society National to keynote at their 2009 Family Support Group Training Conference. And this is a very significant event, since the overall theme was all about young adult research, support, and survivorship. They allowed me to focus the theme of my keynote on my story, on the genesis of I2Y, and how we're actively contributing to national partnerships with regional LLS chapters, all in a collaborative interest with the young cancer community. This event brings together over 200 licensed clinical social workers and nurses from around the country to learn about new research, education, support, and survivorship resources that they can bring back to their respective communities and impart that wisdom to those affected back in their neck of the woods. The attendees are all volunteers to the Leukemia Lymphoma Society, so they're essentially, they facilitate the legitimate on-the-ground, in-the-trenches work that directly benefits patients, families, caregivers with cancer. Highly engaged, mixed crowd of admirable humanity, all volunteers, really amazing stuff. I was invited to steer the collective message of my presentation toward the following specific takeaways, one being that providers don't have experience for what they need to do when it comes to young adults, that there are new best practices to reach the young adult population, what would be helpful to them to run a young adult support group, retention of young adults into the I2Y and Leukemia and Lymphoma Society communities, and that the young adults are not terribly receptive to the old-school traditional models of group therapy, group support. So anyway, it was a really incredible chance to articulate to a hungry-for-resource audience all about how they can embrace the new community model of offline Wiccanomics and foster outsourced collaboration to embrace the new best practices, to engage, empower, and retain young adults and help them get busy living. So being able to explain to them how to engage with us, how we're not about traditional support groups, that this is age-specific and not disease-specific, was really transformative. And I felt that they were captivated by the conversation and really listening to what I was talking about, what was being said about the unique needs facing our generation. So I'd like to extend thanks to the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society for its belief in the young adult cause and for its support of our mission, our vision, and our goals as we move ever forward toward a future where one day the survival rates for young adults will actually meet and or exceed those of everyone else's. So that's sort of the way I think it is. Pretty cool stuff. Welcome to the Stupid Cancer Movement, because we're here to stay and the couch is comfy. We're not about we're not just about the quantity of your life. We're about the quality of your life, folks. Why? Because there's more to the cure than just research. For better or for worse, change comes slowly and only from within. The need to cure cancer for Gen X and Gen Yers, whatever that winds up meaning, is only going to come from within our own ranks. Are we on our own? Well, I say that if we're the generation that invented Google and Facebook, Second Life, and kept Sanjaya on American Idol all those weeks, we should be able to take care of our own. This is Generation Cancer, and it's our fight. We have the sheer numbers, the voting power, and the influence to change the rules, because remission is not a cure, and survivorship is all that matters. So are you in? Because the time is now. It's time. It's about time. It's our time. Donna Martin graduates. And now for a brief pause here, on a much more serious note before we get to the news and our guests, let me just point out that while we're beyond where we came from, we're not where we need to be, and one adult still dies from cancer every hour. We know this is not okay, and it would be virtually impossible to honor and memorialize each and every one of those unacceptable losses. But sometimes someone comes along who finds such an incredible place in your heart, whose courage, strength, and attitude chase away the rain, and whose spirit and energy bring a peaceful calm to any moment. Over the past year or so, I've had the privilege of getting to know a young man battling liver cancer up near Rochester, New York. His name is Zach DeRitter. You may know the name, since he was a former triathlete who, after being diagnosed, committed himself to keeping active until the very end. He had so many fans and friends that he actually won the Live Strong Dare to Share YouTube challenge with an overwhelming number of votes, 54,000. I mean, those ain't American Idol numbers, but we don't care about American Idol here. So to put that in perspective, the second runner-up was 48,000, but the third runner-up was 8,600. He won a bike hand-signed by Lance Armstrong, who was one of his biggest heroes. And that was the impact that this incredible young man had. Well, we lost Zach this weekend. And after living well beyond any doctor's predictions, any family member's expectations, he managed to crank out every bit of life he could before he had to let go. And I was just up in Rochester a few months ago and got to hang out with Zach for almost 18 hours consecutively. We did indoor rock climbing. We rode around in a 300-horsepower Mustang GT rental. We ate garbage plates. looked at the lake, enjoyed some pleasant company. He was one of the biggest fans of our organization, specifically these Stupid Cancer bumper stickers. So I shipped him about 500 of them over the last couple of months, and according to local sources, I think you'd be hard-pressed to find a car that doesn't have it emblazoned on its rear bumper in his neck of the woods. Now, his death is not okay, and is a grim reminder that we have much work to do that is ahead of us. He will be sorely missed, and so I would like to ask everyone out there to share in a brief moment of silence for Zach DeRitter. All right. Thank you very much, everybody. And now the news.
Hello, I'm Kent Brockman, and this is Eye on Cancer.
Just the facts, ma'am.
All righty. During this part of the Stupid Cancer Show, we announce worthy news stories to our adoring listeners to inform them about the latest and greatest in young adult programs, services, events, projects, and other stuff. If you have an upcoming program, event, or press release that you would like to hear broadcast during this segment, please fax it to me at 718-745-1928, 718-745-1928, or email it to stupidcancer@imtooyoungforthis.org. All righty. We're going to breeze through the news here. We'll bring out Jack and our special co-host for tonight, Carol Rosenthal. Okay. The Allman Cancer Fund for Young Adults. This is in the D.C. Metro, Bethesda, Columbia, Baltimore area. Is having a weekly Screw Cancer Happy Hour on the third Wednesday of every month at the Columbia Hilton in Columbia, and the third Thursday of every month at Wharf Rat in Baltimore. Information, go to AllmanFund.org. The Children's Cause for Cancer Advocacy, for those of you on the West Coast, is having Rise to Action, a conference for young adults with cancer, February 7, 2009. We will be exhibiting, we will be attending, and our own Jack Bouffard will be there, pimping us out, sporting his sport. So, all good stuff. For information, go to childrenscause.org. Alrighty, February 27th through March 1st, the 9th annual conference for young women affected by breast cancer in Dallas. Once again, I2Y will be there, Sage Center, exhibiting. We'll have a bunch of folks there giving out tons of swag. If you are a young woman affected by breast cancer, or anyone affected by young women's breast cancer, you are welcome to attend by visiting youngsurvivorsconference.org. Youngsurvivorsconference.org. All right, New York City metro area, this Wednesday, a Stupid Cancer Happy Hour in Long Island, and that is going to be at, you know what? I lost the paper. I guess we're going to have to go to our Google Calendar and find out where the event is. It was at a restaurant called Sidekicks, but they apparently closed down, and I didn't print out the update. But if you're in Long Island, check in with us. We would absolutely love to see you there at our inaugural Long Island event. And this Friday, New York City, our first Wine and Cheese event. Wine in the West Village, 99 Jane Street, 7 p.m. to 10 p.m., Friday, January 23rd. Hosted by the I2Y New York City Metro Chapter. We look forward to seeing you there if you can make it. Wine and cheese for all. What else we got here? Oh, on a side note, I'd like to extend some props out to our latest I2Y musicians from the forthcoming Volume 2 of our benefit CD. Rachel Chatour from Canada describes herself as a mom first, but despite her busy schedule, she's very active in the local live music scene in Canada. As a young adult survivor, she is one of 20 new musicians to be featured on the album, and she got us some kick-ass press on E! Online. So kudos to Rachel for getting us some exposure on E! Online. We Twittered that away, and it's on our blog feed. I guess wrapping up here, Can't Make a Dream, having their ovarian cancer retreat, April 30th. Information, go to campdream.org. And I guess finally here, cancer care, as always, wrapping up with cancer care. Young Adult Support for Life After Cancer. Groups, phone, on the web, in person, one-on-one, you name it, they've got it. Call Julie Larson. Julie Larson, 212-712-6173. Or email her at jlarson, L-A-R-S-O-N, at cancercare.org. All right. We are going to bring on our co-hosts for tonight. Weighing in at, no more weighing in at 200 pounds. From steroids and chemo, it's my pleasure to welcome back Jack Bouffard.
Good evening, Matthew. How are you, pal?
Hey, Jack, how are you doing?
Just fine, thank you. Sad couple of days for the I2I community, losing our great buddy Zach, and my thoughts and prayers are with his family and his friends, and, you know, this is why we do what we do.
It is exactly why we do what we do, and I understand we're going to be bringing on Carol live into the chat in a minute. I don't know which line she was on, but if we can unmute Carol and get her in here, we'd love to have her join us real quick.
Hey, Matt, while Carol's joining us, I have the information regarding the Long Island happy hour this Wednesday night. It's going to be at the Library Cafe on 274 Main Street in Farmingdale.
Excellent.
So the Library Cafe in Farmingdale.
All right.
Hope to see you. Good turnout for it.
So, Carol, yeah. You with us?
Can you hear me, Matthew?
Just fine, my dear. How are you?
I'm doing quite well. The Steelers won last night, and they're going to the Super Bowl. So, you know, I'm a Pittsburgh girl. That makes me very happy.
That's a sport, right? Football, right?
Yeah, that's a sport. It's the guys throwing the pigskin around on the green AstroTurf. Yeah.
You spend enough time on Flickr, you forget these kind of things.
Good.
And Jack can hear you, too. Hi, Carol.
How you doing, Jack?
I'm wonderful, thank you.
Good.
A little flighted, but that's okay. We're glad to have you on the show tonight. I felt a little flighted, but that's okay. I'm over it, but we're glad she's here.
Oh, because we're bringing some XX chromosomes into the mix here.
Yes. Yeah, and Matt, throwing the pigskin around is not a Dancing with the Stars reference. It's a football reference.
I'm so sorry. I hear that. So we are going to bring out our first guest and then have a wonderful conversation with her. Tonight's show is all about cancer prevention, early detection, potential conspiracy theories, and environmental issues that are causing cancer that we may or may not have control over, fostering the potential Mayan end of the world in 2012. What do you guys think?
Hot topic. Good thing to talk about.
I definitely think it's a hot
topic.
Very good. So, let's introduce our first guest here.
What time is it?
Ann Ponta was diagnosed with breast cancer in January of 1993. She knew of no one with the disease. Being chemically sensitive, she refused chemotherapy, later learning that her slow-growing cancer would probably not benefit from it that much anyway. So she chose to explore what was then called alternative medicine. She founded a study group in 1994, put up a website in June of 1999, and the Annie Appleseed Project was born. An all-volunteer network became a nonprofit in 2003 and received about 90,000 hits a month, providing information, education, and advocacy on complementary and alternative natural integrative therapies for all types of cancer. Please welcome to the Stupid Cancer Show, Ann Ponta.
Hi.
Hi, Ann. How you doing?
I'm doing really well. I've been listening and enjoying your show. Very interesting.
Thank you. We're trying to have some fun here.
Yeah, you know, cancer can be fun if it's not, you know.
Well, you gotta have some kind of sense of humor about it. If you take things too seriously, I think your head will implode.
I have to agree with you. That's great.
So you were diagnosed with breast cancer in 1993. How old were you?
44.
That counts in my book as being way too young for this.
Yeah, thank you. I just missed your cutoff, but my heart was young for sure.
Yeah, we're not quite Soylent Green. You know, a lot of people think that. But it definitely, you know, you're part of our demo, and it means a lot. Now, when you say you knew of no one with the disease, does that mean you had no idea 44-year-old women got breast cancer, or you didn't meet anybody who was your age that had it?
I didn't know anybody with the disease, and people went out of their way to tell me about their next-door neighbor's cousin who died of breast cancer. So going into it, I was pretty nervous. Someone called me the night before I went into surgery and told me she was a 10-year survivor, and I think that really changed my mindset.
Yeah, I'm going to go with hearing about success stories versus death rates to be a real plus.
Yeah, yeah. But people, you know, people don't get that. I think maybe they do now, but 16, 17 years ago, they wanted to tell me about all their dead friends with chemo. With cancer. It was pretty bad.
Yeah, I mean, I was diagnosed with a pediatric brain cancer that had like a 40% survival rate, and it was only in little kids who died. So
yeah.
I only had negative things spoken about what I was going through, and it was impossible to find anyone who survived it. So I'm right there with you.
And I think the mind-body-spirit connection is a pretty good thing to exercise, so have that positive vibe is very valuable, and what you're doing is providing that for people. It's pretty great.
Yeah, and I appreciate that. That's very meaningful. I think we live in an age now where that's more sort of a cultural acceptance that this isn't witchcraftery and chicanery anymore, that there's a legitimacy to attitude and holism and mind-body. And it took like 30 years for it to actually, you know, make sense to the masses, but you were ahead of your time, apparently.
Well, in cancer, I've noticed things go awfully slowly. I sometimes think we ought to call medicine technology instead of science, because technology, you zoom around every week, it changes. Medicine 20, 30 years is nothing.
Right, and the theme of today's show is, you know, where are we now with respect to where we were? Where can we go with what we now know? And there's so much conversation to have about, you know, what role CAM plays in our daily lives, how it can actually influence things, but the factors that cause the need for it aren't being addressed, and how do you manage to live as well as possible with what's available?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because when I was diagnosed, I remember my oncologist saying to me, "You want to do yoga? Are you crazy?" And that was a scary thing back then, and so many things have been incorporated into the world of cancer now. It's understood that we'll have a better shot if we get some exercise, we take a walk, we eat healthier, we relax a little bit, we detox. I mean, it's starting to be an understood and is important, and that's really meaningful. And for me, it was the major way that I survived because, as you mentioned, I didn't do chemotherapy and I didn't do radiation therapy either, and for a variety of reasons, but I had to do something. And so I started to explore what now we call complementary medicine, and there really are a ton of things that could work, and they're worth a try. And especially, as you know, as all of us know, the treatment is so difficult and so causes so many problems long and short term that not doing complementary therapy is a mistake.
And
need to protect
and who were some of the early adopters in your mind? Where did it sort of trip from being, just like foo-foo witchcraft to, maybe we should start thinking about this?
Well, here's an interesting success story. There's a guy named Stanislaw Brzezinski who actually is very involved in brain cancer and has been working for over 30 years in Houston, Texas. And he was arrested several times for doing voodoo, and now the FDA just gave him approval to study phase 3 glioma. And originally he had asked for phase 3 for children, and they've given him phase 3 for glioma for children and adults. They now see the value of his therapy.
And, I mean, I'm friends with Bernie Siegel. I've been friends with him for about 8 years now.
Oh, yeah.
He got demonized in the 80s for talking about this kind of stuff.
Yeah,
and
that's
now
right.
He's so vindicated for having given birth to the notion. Like the fact of what you said, like, yoga, you're crazy. Who does yoga with cancer? But it's like part of hospitals now. They do in-hospital yoga now. So
yeah, that's right. That's right. And acupuncture is very well accepted, too. I mean, they now know it really makes a difference for nausea and vomiting, which really no fun at all. So it can really help. And it's good for a lot of other things, too.
I was shocked when I went in for my last surgery. They asked me, as I was registering and coming in, if I would like acupuncture in my room after surgery and
wow.
How soon after surgery I wanted it. But this was in San Francisco, which is sort of
a little
a different country in many ways. So,
too.
Yeah, and I was part of an acupuncture study here in Connecticut when I was going through treatment.
Well, cool. Well, you know, to me, the biggest problem we have is that the pharmaceutical model is the one that's followed first. So when even studying natural products, they'll study it in a way that you study a drug. And you can't do nutrient versus no nutrient the way you would do drug versus no drug and make any sense, because nutrients go together. And our science system is set up to look at things separately, so that's a problem. It's hard
I have a question about that. I'm curious about what are the models that would be useful to study complementary and alternative medicine if they don't quite fit into the mold of other allopathic studies. What kinds of studies or in what way can research be done?
Well, I think people call it whole systems research. And the idea would be, if you're looking at nutrients, you would look at a variety of foods and a variety of supplements together rather than try to separate them. I don't think you can tease it out anyway. I think it's kind of crazy to say, oh, yeah, it's beta-carotene when, you know, a carrot has so many nutrients. A blueberry or raspberry has so many nutrients. It's not just something called ellagic acid, which researchers get excited about. You know, it's not any one thing. And I think it needs to be looked at in a totality. It's the same with Chinese medicine. Traditional Chinese medicine, there's many herbal formulas, and if you just take one and study that on 30 people, chances are it won't work for them because, you know, they need a formula that's right for them, not that they have to be right for the formula, and we're making a mistake with that. But interestingly, Western medicine in the form of the genomic project actually recognized that people are different. So they now say, and Francis Collins, who was the guy who was heading up that project, he said, we discovered that people with breast cancer, for example, don't all have the same genes that are turned on and off. And Chinese medicine 6,000 years ago said the same thing. They said, same disease, we might need different treatment. You know, different disease might need the same treatment. And so we all agree.
Let me jump in for a second because, excuse me, it's funny because, not funny, but I guess where I'm going with this is that one of the issues that Dr. Davis is going to talk about later is this notion of environmental ecology, where we've engendered sort of a biosphere that is not conducive to health. So our bodies are getting sicker as a result of that, and cancer is one of the most predominant things, you know, asthma and autism and all this other stuff. So we need better medicine to sort of counteract the symptoms. Is there a parallel here where we might need to, where we might overwhelm natural causes to the point where they're just so ineffective because our biosphere is so bad?
See, I don't think so at all. I think, in fact, we need to eat, well, first of all, there's always a counter trend, and the counter trend is strong, and that's organic food and healthier lifestyle. And there have been studies that show that the combination of eating healthy and doing physical movement or exercise are really valuable to our health, and they're better together. And if you think about it, that's part of the natural order, that we are active and that we eat the, you know, appropriate foods. We know when we export our Western diet, they don't call it the sad standard American diet for no reason. It's terrible. When we export that, people get sick. They get heart disease, they get diabetes, and they get cancer. So I think it's more a question of doing the healthy behaviors that we should naturally be doing, and, of course, all the time and always fighting back against more plastic in our environment, more chemicals, more pollutants. It's the combination of what we do to ourselves and what the environment is.
I mean,
you know,
the reason I ask that is because I hear story after story of people who were the epitome of perfect health, and they got cancer.
Right.
But they still got it. I mean,
right.
Are those disparities? Are those random flukes? Or is there something more to the story?
Yeah, I think I always say to people, you know, you can't control everything in your environment, and we have a lot of garbage. But if you think about the fact that 1.5 million people are diagnosed every year, most of them are not vegetarians. Most of them are not doing yoga. You know, the people who do stand out in your mind. I was a vegetarian when I was diagnosed, but I was one of those people who gave up meat but didn't understand that eating healthy wasn't just a question of not eating meat. So I was having Entenmann's donuts and not eating meat, or going to Wendy's and having everything but the hamburgers. I was having the secret sauce, the lettuce, tomato, the bun, the whole deal, French fries, all those things that are not healthy food
in defense of Entenmann's and Wendy's, come on, they're really awful.
Yeah, right.
It may not be healthy, but it's good.
Yeah, and Entenmann's hard for me to trash, that's right. But, you know, but the truth is that you know, eating organic fruits and vegetables is definitely better than not eating them. And there's even evidence that shows children very clearly benefit. They have a week of eating just organic, the chemicals that are pesticides and so on leave their bloodstream in 1 week, 7 days. So that's pretty darn good.
You know, Matthew, I asked that question a lot myself about the healthy people because I was one of those healthy people. I was vegetarian, and I was not an Entenmann's vegetarian. I was like a, you know, haul my ass to the co-op and buy the brown rice and cook it up myself and soak my beans overnight in organic carrots kind of vegetarian. And I was vegan for 7 years, and I was a dancer. So 6 days a week I was in the dance studio. And I was really, you know, kind of crunchy, healthy girl. And for so long after I was diagnosed, I was just sort of resistant to doing any kind of diet and physical exercise. And I really shouldn't use that in the past tense because I was diagnosed 8 years ago, and it's not that I'm running out to the gym now, but I'm still kind of willing myself to do it all because for the longest time I thought, what's the point? Because there are cases of people like myself who led these very healthy lifestyles. And I brought this up recently with an acupuncturist who said, well, you know, you look at the equation as you were very healthy, so what good did being healthy do you? And he said, you know, it's possible that it did a lot of good. It's possible that you would have been stage four instead of stage two. You know, you're assuming that because you had cancer that your healthy lifestyle didn't do you any good, and maybe it did a lot of good. Maybe it, you know, gave you the extra boost in your immune system so that, you know, your body wasn't totally trashed. And I thought that was a really good point because it's so easy to look at it as, you know, all or nothing.
I love that. I think that's really right. My cancer turned out to be very slow-growing, as Matthew mentioned in the introduction, and I think that was really important. I could have had a very aggressive tumor, but I think, you know, we live in a really bad world with a lot of poison, and our bodies react, and you don't know what your exposures are. Now it turns out like it might matter what happens in utero. I mean, you can't control that stuff, you know. You can't control your birth order, your height, you know. The most you can do is control what you can control, and that's the version that I take. And I think it's a really good idea to look at it as a positive benefit. And like I said, you know, 1.5 million people getting cancer, most of them are not healthy. And, you know, you do the best you can. But we're still here. That's the good news.
We are still here. Let me ask you a question about the Annie Appleseed Project. First of all, why'd you call it Annie Appleseed? And secondly, how was your big conference last week?
Thank you for asking. Let's see. I have a very brilliant sister, and I had a brilliant mother, and I asked them to brainstorm with me. And we talked all day. I fell asleep. I woke up and I said, we're spreading seeds, we're sowing seeds. And then I got Appleseed, and my name is Ann, so Annie, Appleseed, and Project. And that was it. And it's a fun name. I love it. The conference ended up being amazing. We had 200 people, 14 speakers, 20 exhibitors, all organic food, no soda, and very interesting talk. I just put up a bunch of pictures on our website. People can see what it looked like and what the crowd was like, and we also have CDs available. But it was very educational. The idea was the evidence behind natural therapies, because we had a lot of nurses there and some MDs. We want people to understand that there is plenty of evidence. It's not what they call level one, the gold standard, which is a multi-centered, randomized clinical trial. But those cost almost, you know, they cost $800 million to do, and they take about 12 years. And natural products, you can't patent them, as the pharmaceutical industry has often said to me, and therefore they're not interested, and it's very difficult to get those studies done. But again, nutrient versus no nutrients, not a very successful study anyway. And it costs so much money to find out that, yeah, fruits and vegetables are good for you. You know, it's kind of over the top.
I mean, there's another...
I have a question about that, because I am curious about what funding is available in the more naturopathic community, because it is a multi-billion dollar grossing industry. The alternative medicine and natural health and vitamins and things like that. And I'm wondering, you know, what kind of money is available that might not necessarily be tapped, because I don't necessarily see this as an economic underdog, you know, this the alternative medicine world. And I'm wondering if you feel that funds are being used, or if there are ways that we could harness more money for these kinds of studies.
Yeah, that's a good point too. We try to lobby those groups that work with the manufacturers of supplements as well. And one of the things that happens is there's an organization for supplements that are available only through naturopathic physicians or acupuncturists or chiropractors, and they're much better quality than what's available in the stores. You know, their quality is fits all the standards that the FDA has for pharmaceutical, in that they use the good manufacturing practices and better level. They have the U.S. Pharmacopoeia approval. They have standardized contents. everything that's on the label is what's in the bottle and nothing else. And those kinds of things are pretty much not available through a health food store or a drug store or anything like that. And it's unfortunate. You need to go to a practitioner to get the better quality of supplements. And we do work with them and lobby them to try to get it together. And eventually, I suppose, they'll get mature enough to do studies as a group, but that has not happened for the most part. They will fund studies of their own products sometimes. And there are some manufacturers who are doing that. I mean, there's a product called Ave, which is being studied. It's a fermented wheat germ. It comes from Hungary, and that's being researched through FDA standardized methods. And a couple of other groups like that are doing it. And I think the Brzezinski success story is going to move more people to bring their products through FDA. But I have to say that I hope FDA cleans its act up, because unfortunately it's kind of been a bit politicized in the last few years.
Yeah, which brings up the issue of, you know, what can we do as citizens to continue to champion, you know, the against the, to use the word against implies like there's intent and all that, but, you know, the natural ingredients are not patentable. There is no monetized interest from the drug company industry that has billions of dollars, but they do spend billions on Western medicine, and it is complementary and alternative. You'd think they'd want to go hand in hand with these things. What are some of the things that people can do, you know, outside of their own decisions to get educated and objective about buying the right things or living a healthier lifestyle, to raise awareness? Because that's really what this is about.
Yeah, I think that some of the patient advocate groups are doing, you know, lobbying and advocacy in a pretty strong way these days. We try to do advocacy around the idea of understanding, acceptance. We like to think that we can bridge the gap and talk to oncologists more. And I think people need to read the information and get educated as much as possible. There isn't really any organization that's leading the way on its own. You know, it's like, I mean, right now I'm sure you all know there are all different disease groups that work with people, and that's pretty much how it's done. And we kind of need to get together much more. I'm not sure how they can do it. I mean, people can contact us if they have, if they want to go forward with support for complementary therapies. We'd be happy to, you know, to tell them what action is happening right now. There are things. There are organizations that send me emails all the time, and then I try to send them out to our email list and get people going. But it's pretty fragmented.
Well, you know, we're unfortunately out of time, but. Are there any specific takeaways? Do you have any other things coming up? How can people find out more about you and your organization?
Well, I definitely think they should go to our website and see what's available. We have literally thousands of pages, and our really strong point is that people should combine healthy behaviors, not just one thing. We really think it's a relaxation, it's exercise, it's detoxification, using supplements, and eating healthy go together, and then treatment on top of that, because if you're at your healthiest, then you can accept treatment, which is so hard to do. So hard to take.
Well, I really thank you for being on our show. We'll definitely have to have you back. This is clearly an issue we could talk for hours about, and
right,
it's very captivating,
so much more.
And it's very relevant to where we are today. And hopefully we'll be in a better place starting tomorrow once the inauguration is finished.
Oh, we all hope so.
Yeah.
Thanks
so,
a lot.
So, Anne, thank you so much for being my guest on the show. Good luck to you, and we'll be in touch.
Great. Thanks a lot. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Anne Fonseca, everybody, from the Annie Appleseed Project. 9:38. My second guest this evening is the director of the world's first Center for Environmental Oncology at the University of Pittsburgh Cancer Institute, the author of two critically acclaimed books and over 190 publications. She has advised governments throughout the world on environmental health hazards. President Clinton appointed her to the Chemical Safety and Hazard Investigation Board, and she served as the founding director on the Board of Environmental Studies and Toxicology at the National Academy of Sciences, and the senior advisor to the Assistant Secretary for Health as the lead author of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. So no stranger to getting stuff done. Please welcome to the Stupid Cancer Show our returning champion, Dr. Devra Davis. Devra, you with us?
I certainly am.
Thank you for being
Dr. Davis
on the show.
Hi.
We are joined by Jack Bouffard and Carol Rosenthal, our two co-guests tonight, both survivors, both big fans of what you're doing, and I gave them all homework to do, and they got lots of questions. They want to hear your talk.
Well, great. I look forward to talking with you.
All right. Carol, you want to start off?
Sure. I'm so excited to talk to you, Deborah. I actually grew up in Pittsburgh and spent much of my youth playing in slag heaps and roaming around in steel mills, and I always wonder in the back of my head, does that have anything to do with the fact that I have thyroid cancer? So lots of good questions that I have for you tonight.
Well, let me just say I'm a Steelers fan, as you are. Glad to see that they're in the Super Bowl. But the downside of growing up in Pittsburgh in the Monongahela Valley is exactly what the question you're asking is all about. Namely, we know that there's a residue of waste from steel that have had a variety of effects. Now, of course, I can't tell you whether or not your thyroid cancer has anything to do with
that. Sure.
But I can say this. All of you talk about being vegetarians, leading healthy lives, and somehow still having the bad luck to get cancer. And it's really important that we make the connection here. You can do a lot of good things, and you still end up with cancer. So it's important to understand that it's the sum total of your experiences in life, your nutrition, your exercise, your yoga, your connection to others, to God, however you feel about yourself and your family, and the environment in which you grow up and in which you live.
I'm curious to know when you first started making this connection between cancer and the environment, because you're a real pioneer in this area. And when did those two ideas start to merge for you?
Well, in some sense, they merged intellectually, perhaps 30, 40 years ago, but it really hit home when my 54-year-old father was diagnosed with bone cancer and told me he'd lived a long life. And it was just mind-boggling to me. Now I'm much older than he was at the time, and I realized that he had worked in the steel mills. He had survived a fire and an explosion of benzene. He'd had multiple x-rays when he was in the military, and that it seemed so obviously unfair, as it does to anyone when you lose a family member to this disease. I began to really look in greater detail, and I also started to look at the numbers, because I'm an epidemiologist, and we count things, and I began to become aware, as I think everyone on this show understands, that there were increasing numbers of cancer in people that had nothing to do with smoking and nothing to do with improved screening. And I began to run the numbers, so to speak, and those numbers started to tell a very interesting and I think important story. As you know, there are many more survivors of childhood cancer than ever before. That's the good news. We really can treat and cure many cancers in young people. But the bad news is that there are increasing numbers of cases of them. So it was the realization that those numbers really hit home when my own father was diagnosed with the disease now close to 40 years ago.
Can you talk a little bit about how you moved forward in the development for the Environmental Oncology Center that you run at the University of Pittsburgh, and talk a little bit about the work that you're doing there now?
Certainly. I've been very, very fortunate. My boss is Ron Herbermann. He's one of the most distinguished cancer biologists of all time. He's published over 700 articles. He discovered natural killer cells. And he called me at a time that was very difficult in my life when my mother was quite sick with stomach cancer, and asked me what I would do to set up a program on the environment and cancer. And frankly, I thought I didn't want to take up his time. I was fairly preoccupied. But he was very insistent. And I learned subsequently that the reason that Dr. Ronald B. Herbermann was so insistent was in part a personal. He himself had developed chronic lymphocytic leukemia, and his brother, who was a physician as well, also had the same disease. And the probability that these two physicians would develop this disease with no family history was just very, very high. And so he became convinced that we had to pay more attention to the environment. And as the director of the Cancer Institute at the University of Pittsburgh, he created the opportunity for me to develop this program. And as I said to others, he kind of called my bluff. I said, Donna, what would you really do if you were given an opportunity to create such a program? And that's how we started.
And tell us a little bit about the work that you're doing right now at the center and what your sort of day-to-day activities are there.
Well, we have four basic programs.
And the one I think that I hope your listeners will look at is our public outreach and education program. There's a website, preventingcancernow.org, and it includes information on how to green your life, how to get rid of the bads that cause cancer and do more of the goods. And it also provides information for children as well as adults. So it's intended to address the public broadly about the things you can do that will reduce the risk of cancer. One of the things that we have highlighted there is the work of David Servan-Schreiber, who has written a wonderful new book, Anti-Cancer, A New Way of Life. And Dr. Servan-Schreiber is himself an MD, PhD, with a very unusual history. He was diagnosed with brain cancer 16 years ago as a young man, age 33. And he's now still alive and doing very, very well. And he attributes his success to the fact that he used the best of conventional medicine along with the best of nutrition and yoga and other things that you and your listeners know all about. So Dr. David Servan-Schreiber's work is one of the things that we feature on our website. We also have a program of basic research where we do studies in laboratories with whole animals and cell cultures, where we look at things like broccoli and fish oil and garlic and dark chocolate and their ability to actually suppress cancer growth. And we do epidemiologic and clinical studies where we look at patterns of cancer in populations and we see whether there are changes in the incidence of cancer, particularly in young people, that we think provide clues. And finally, we have a program with the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center where we are greening the hospital to walk the talk, to reduce our use of toxic materials in cleaning, to reduce our dependence on dirty fossil fuels. And so the whole program is integrated into an effort to do the research on what are the good things that will prevent cancer and to try to put that research into action.
You know, I want to get back for a moment to the component that you were talking about steps that we can take to green our lives. And as a cancer patient, sometimes it's hard for me to toe the line between being safe and sensible about toxins versus what I often write about, which I call enviro-paranoia. And it's a lot of pressure trying to, you know, be a healthy person, a cancer patient, and live this life that sometimes I look around and think, oh, my God, am I just poisoning myself? And it's easy to become kind of paranoid about this. How do you find that there is, or in what ways, I guess, would you advise that people go about taking on this task of greening their lives, but being able to do it in a way where they prioritize the decisions that they make so that it doesn't become something that's so fearful or monumental?
Right. It should not be a burden. And everybody has to, first of all, breathe and remember to breathe and take the time to think about what it is you can do that you're comfortable with. Nobody can do it all, and you don't want to drive yourself crazy in a kind of manic binge of leading the perfect life. That's why the Center for Environmental Oncology exists, to give you information about the things you can do, but also to help the government and the private sector figure out the changes they need to make. Because right now, despite the economic crisis, the fastest growing sector of the economy continues to be things that are going green, that are being more energy efficient and less polluting. At the same time, we can't think that this is only something you as an individual can do. There is a role here for the government. The economic stimulus package, for example, will and must include programs that are environmentally sustainable and not simply the old bricks and mortar programs of cement and asphalt where we try to make the world safe for bigger and more highways. Just as a matter of fact, we know that more highways you build in certain areas, the more traffic you're going to get, and that's not a solution to anything. So the solution has got to be things like public transport and things that reduce our ecological footprint. And that's going to take some thinking outside of the box. And I'm speaking to you today from Washington, D.C., where I'm very excited to be celebrating the inauguration of our new president. And tomorrow there'll be the environmental ball that I'm participating in, and I'm thrilled that we seem to have a president and new appointees that understand that we've got to change our old habits in order to create a healthier world. So it's no longer going to be the burden on the cancer patient to figure out, oh, my gosh, what do I need to do about every aspect of life? But instead, what can we as a society to do? What can the private sector do? What does the government need to do to make the world safer for all of us?
I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit more about what the government can do. Recently, Barack Obama selected Lisa Jackson as the head of the EPA, and I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about what the director of the EPA does and how the work that's actually done at the EPA impacts our daily lives and our cancer burden or cancer risks.
The EPA plays a profound effect on public health that is not widely appreciated. The EPA has the potential to have an enormous effect because, for example, all new chemicals are supposed to be registered through the EPA, and yet in the past, the EPA and the Occupational Safety and Health Administration never did the work that it was supposed to do, and as a consequence, they set no new standards for chemicals. Workplace recommendations have really fallen behind. The United States now has taken second and third place to Europe and Japan when it comes to occupational safety and health. We and Canada are the only two modern nations not to have banned asbestos. There will be a trial starting in February in Montana that was started by the Bush administration to prosecute companies for failing to warn people about the dangers of asbestos in Libby, Montana. The Bush administration is starting that prosecution, which now will be taken over by the Obama administration, because criminal behavior was engaged in by these companies that would distribute asbestos throughout the country, and people didn't even know, had no information about this. So I think there's tremendous excitement. Lisa Jackson's appointment is a real shot in the arm, because this is a woman who has studied the issues and has worked on questions of environmental health and justice for much of her career. And she brings a real fresh and new experience. She is, as far as I know, the first scientist administrator that we will have. All the other EPA administrators have tended to have legal backgrounds. Not that that's necessarily a problem, as Seinfeld would say. Not that there's anything wrong with that.
It's just nice to have some science back in the process at this
point. It would be quite refreshing because it's been quite absent. And there's been, I don't think that most people appreciate that the Bush administration policies on science have been for science what Joseph McCarthy was for politics.
All right, that gets an applause button.
Yes.
You got the applause there.
Thank you, Matthew.
Well said.
Right. But the larger issue now is it's a very exciting time. I think we all hope that the new president and the administration will give them enough time to do the right thing, but that they won't get bogged down in the old thing. And you were talking before with my friend Ann Fonfa about alternative medicine. I think we should stop using the term alternative medicine, quite frankly. I think that all medicine needs to be used. When you've got cancer and you're young, you can't wait for a clinical trial. You can't wait for someone to come back in 5 years and tell you what a good thing is to do. You've got to do the best you can with the newest information in conventional medicine and then make decisions with your health professional and your family about what other things might give you a better chance. And again, David Servan-Schreiber in his new book, Anti-Cancer, explains exactly how he went about doing that. He had the best medical treatment, by the way, at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center, but he also supplemented that with information that he has acquired on nutrition and yoga and other things.
And David was supposed to be our guest tonight. He had to cancel for a last-minute trip to Paris, so Dr. Davis is subbing in his place last minute. I owe you a beer for that one, definitely.
All right.
But we're trying to get him back on the show because his book, Anti-Cancer, is phenomenal.
Yes.
And it's part of – it's like we should get you and him and Tom Daschle on this show as soon as possible.
Well, I think the senator, now the secretary-designate, will have a lot of things to do. But, Matthew, quite seriously, I think it is important that there has to be a fundamentally new approach taken to cancer treatment and prevention. And I'm encouraged by several new appointments that the administration has made. The new director of the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences is a brilliant scientist named Linda Birnbaum, who understands the importance of looking at mixtures and understands that no matter how good a diet you eat and how well you take care of yourself, you still can end up with cancer if you have had the bad luck to live and grow up in a lousy environment, as perhaps you did in Pittsburgh at the time that you were growing up there.
You know, I'm curious if you can talk a little bit more about geography and cancer risk factors.
Well, you know, that's scientifically one of the most challenging things we face, is trying to sort through the puzzle of geography and cancer. And we have some interesting clues. In China, there are areas with extremely high rates of liver cancer and extremely high rates of certain fungus and aflatoxin molds. And we know that there is an interaction there, but it's unusual and exceptional. We got the first clue that asbestos could cause cancer in people outside of factories when maps were made in the United States, very basic maps at the county level, that found that there were shipyard-related counties on the coast of the United States where women who were not then smokers had very high rates of lung cancer, and that led to understanding that there was a geographic association between exposure to asbestos from the shipyard repairs and manufacturing and lung cancer in women. But when you can get those associations rarely. Unfortunately, because for breast cancer is so common, we will find areas like Marin County, like Teton County, Wyoming, where there are high rates of breast cancer, and we will not be able to pinpoint what the causes are because there are so many different factors and breast cancer is so common. But geographic patterns of cancer can be very, very valuable, and they often provide clues. Another kind of clue we get is to look at trends in cancer over time. And that's something that I'm doing now with other colleagues at MD Anderson, where we're looking, in fact, Matthew, spurred in part by some of your statements about the numbers, the growing numbers of young cancer survivors, it turns out, you're not going to be surprised to hear this, that you're right. There are more cases of cancer today occurring in young people. It's not just because there are more people. The rate per 100,000 has increased. And we're very concerned about what could explain this increase in malignant gliomas of the brain in people in their 20s. And we don't have an answer, but we think it's important to first document the trend and then look at what could be behind it. And that is why we are very concerned about cell phone patterns in young people today.
You know, which brings up like an entire other show's worth of conversation. We're actually running out of time, but clearly I think we could dedicate an entire show in the next couple of weeks to just cell phones.
And I think that, you know, if you want to do that, I think you should include scientists from Sweden, whom I know who are fluent in English, and Finland, because the Finnish Radiation Protection Agency just last week announced a warning about marketing and selling of cell phones to children in Finland. Now, this is the home of Nokia. You can find information on this by looking at the website devradavis.com, where I provide the latest advisories from the French government and the Finnish government on this issue. Since we've just raised this issue, let me just say this. I use a cell phone. Cell phones have transformed our lives. I think there are safer ways to use cell phones that will reduce their impact on our health, if there is one. And it is a matter of grave concern because most of the world now is using cell phones, and there are many countries where there are almost nothing but cell phones. There are no landlines.
And just quickly before we go, can you toss out one or two tips that people can take to use their cell phones
Certainly. More
carefully?
Sure. Text instead of using the phone. Try to avoid having the phone directly to your ear. Use a speakerphone or an earpiece. That's very simple things to do. Don't carry the phone on your body all the time. Specific advice can be found on the website, again, devradavis.com or preventingcancernow.org. I do agree it's a very important issue that we should explore further.
And you know what? We'll talk offline because we would love to work with you on helping to produce that show and securing a really all-star cast of compelling guests.
And I'll be happy to help.
Excellent.
All right.
once again, you saved my neck by filling in for David. I really appreciate it. You're doing amazing stuff. We are totally behind you, and we're your biggest fans.
Well, thank you so much. I'm a big fan of you guys.
Well, thank you.
Right. Thank you, Dr. Davis.
All right. Bye-bye.
All right. Deborah Davis, everybody. Director of the Environmental Oncology Division at the University of Pittsburgh. Cancer Center, author of the book, The Secret History of the War on Cancer. All right, Jack and Carol, thank you guys so much for being on the show tonight.
Thanks, Matt.
Good
it was great.
With you.
Good show, Carol.
Yeah.
Good to be here.
Well, let's do it again sometime.
Sounds good.
Absolutely.
All right. Good night, guys. Now it's time for our closing sequence.
Good enough.
What time is it?
Prepare to activate.
I hear there's rumors on the internets.
You ever seen a grown man naked?
And so, to all of you, a fond farewell.
Hooray, I'm helping.
You are a meathead.
Oh, Magoo, you've done it again.
That was so terrible, I think you gave me cancer.
All right, folks, that's tonight's show. I hope you had as much fun as we did poking a stick at stupid cancer. I'd like to thank my co-hosts, Jack Bouffard and Carol Rosenthal, and our guests, Anne Fonfa and Dr. Deborah Davis. Next week, a special show dedicated to bereaved young adult spouses. They do exist, and they need help. We're here for them. So please join me with Matt Herning from the Young Cancer Spouses Foundation and Anya Cohn-Minton, grief spouse from Ohio. It's going to be a great show. Same bad time, same bad channel, 9 p.m. Eastern, right here on the internet. The show will be podcasted for your viewing and listening pleasure. And we'll see you all back here next week, live from the chemo deck. Captain Stubing and I wish you all a phenomenal evening. Good night, folks. It's an open smile.